From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Happy Election Day. On today's show, the film that captured Aretha Franklin's landmark 1972 gospel performance is finally being released. Then it took Morgan Neville years to make his film about Orson Welles' final movie, The Other Side of the Wind, which Welles also worked on for a very long time.
And The Other Side of the Wind is a film about a film director at the end of his life that can't finish a movie. And Orson shot this film for 6 years and never finished it. So it's the most meta story of all time.
And we take a ride along with cast members from the series Mayans MC. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix film The Other Side of the Wind. Witness the last film from legendary director Orson Welles, a cinematic event 40 years in the making. The Other Side of the Wind, streaming now only on Netflix.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. In 1972, Aretha Franklin took to the altar at the New Temple Missionary Baptist Church in South LA, and what followed is considered one of the greatest performances of gospel music ever, memorialized in the album Amazing Grace. It wasn't just parishioners and music fans like Mick Jagger who were in the pews back then. A young film director named Sidney Pollack was on hand to make a movie about Franklin's performance. But Pollack, who was inexperienced in shooting a live concert, and his crew made several critical mistakes. After Pollack died, producer Alan Elliott spent decades trying to put the film together, but then encountered another obstacle. Aretha herself objected to the film's release and sued to block it. Now Franklin's estate has agreed to finally let the film come out. It will debut next Monday at the Doc NYC Festival, followed by week-long Oscar qualifying runs in L.A. and New York. Elliott joined us via Skype from the Hollywood studio today as he was racing to complete the film's sound mix.
Well, we have to premiere on Monday at Doc NYC. As my friend Lorne Michaels likes to say, it doesn't have to be perfect, but it has to be ready at 11:30 on Saturday. And we have to be ready at 6:30 on Monday.
So this film dates back to 1972, but Sidney Pollack made a big mistake. He didn't use clapper boards. So how hard was it overall to get the music to sync up with the images? And how much of a problem was that in this film never getting released earlier?
I think Sidney was probably in the middle of trying to finish post-production for Jeremiah Johnson, which had gone long, and there wasn't a lot of pre-production. And what had happened was he had hired cameramen who were used to doing, weren't used to doing documentaries. They were turning the cameras on, turning them off, turning them on, turning them off without the clapper boards. And they got back to the editing facility. And remember, it's 1972. So they would be hanging, you know, with paper clips, all of the film takes. So supposedly they had about 1,000 or 2,000 takes with no edit points and no way to sync it with audio.
I heard at one point that somebody subsequently brought in a lip reader to try to synchronize the audio, that
yes,
they were actually getting somebody who worked with hearing impaired people to try to sync the mouth movements with music?
Yes, they hired the choir director, Alexander Hamilton, to come in and work for a couple months and got, I think, 153 minutes of the 15 or 20 hours of footage that was done sunk together, but no complete songs. And they just decided to give up. And Warner Brothers wrote off the project, and Sidney went and got The Way We Were, and he had another career. And I know he wanted to finish it. We had talked about it in 1990 when I worked as a staff producer at Atlantic Records, which is when I found out about the project. I mean, you know, when I started a project in 2007 with Jerry Wexler, who had been my mentor over at Atlantic Records, we had gone to Sydney and started it. And before we could get the film, you know, over to start to get looked at, Sydney had gotten pancreatic cancer and then passed away.
I first met you at the Telluride Film Festival in 2015. And you were going to show this film at the festival a couple of hours later. And Aretha Franklin's lawyers tracked the festival director, Julie Huntsinger, down and blocked the exhibition of the film. There was a big legal battle. How were you able to resolve the legal issues that Aretha Franklin and now I guess her estate had with the film?
for Aretha Franklin, who must have been inundated with it and was coming from a different time and a different world, I can only imagine that she didn't trust anybody. Now, what we didn't know 3 years ago was how sick she was. Inside her family is a woman named Sabrina Owens, who is now the executor of the will. And she and I struck up a friendship. When Aretha passed, Sabrina called me and invited me to come to the funeral in Detroit. A couple weeks after that, she called me back and said, we'd like to see the movie. And I said, great. My producing partner, Terrell Whitley, and myself flew to Detroit to show the family the movie 5 weeks ago last Friday. And, you know, it was only 4 weeks, I think, or 3 weeks after Aretha had passed.
You take the film, you show it to her family at the Charles Wright African American Museum in Detroit. What was their reaction? Because they hadn't seen the film before that, had they?
No. And at the end of the movie, they were crying. And we sat down and we hung out for a little while. And then Sabrina called me on the ride home at my hotel. And she said, okay, let's do it. And then we sort of wanted to create this for us, by us experience, because the one thing that I learned in the 3 years since Telluride was it would be better to own the movie and market it the way we think it would be better for the legacy of Aretha. To that, we're doing events with the Poor People's Campaign with Reverend Barber. We're going to do some work with the Clean Water for Flint. In working directly with the family and having this kind of bond, we were like, okay, let's qualify for the Oscars. So clandestinely, that deadline was October 1st, and we went to Tom Oyer over at the Academy, and we said, we don't want this to leak out. We just want to get the DigiLink up. We want to get you the DVDs so that people can watch the movie when that drops, but we want to be able to announce in November. We laughed because we said, you know, Aretha wouldn't just want to go for Best Documentary. Aretha would want to go for Best Picture. So we're having fun with it. And, you know, Monday we'll be premiering at Doc NYC, and Reverend Al Sharpton will be doing a little invocation before the show. And then we do our qualifying run November 20th through the 27th in Los Angeles, and in New York, the 7th through the 14th at Film Forum. And it's really exciting.
Alan Elliott is the producer of Amazing Grace. Alan, thanks so much for coming on the show.
I appreciate it, John. Thank you.
Coming up, Morgan Neville released his documentary about Fred Rogers earlier this year. His new film takes on the complicated filmmaker Orson Welles.
KPCC podcast supporters include UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting LA's Uncabaret, celebrating 25 years with this one-time-only evening of live comedy, music, and never-before-seen footage from the vault. Featuring Beth Lapidus, Julia Sweeney, Janine Garofalo, Bob Odenkirk, Greg Barron, and Jill Soloway. Also featuring Maria Bamford, Julie Goldman, Byron Bowers, Justin Sayer, and surprise guests. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Orson Welles is having a moment. The filmmaker may have died in 1985, but there are two movies on Netflix now that have brought Welles and his work back to life. One is The Other Side of the Wind, which was the last scripted movie that Welles made as a director. It stars John Huston as an aging filmmaker who's a veiled stand-in for Welles. Welles never finished it. Producer Frank Marshall has just put it all together. The other Welles movie is a documentary about the tortured making of The Other Side of the Wind, and what a story that is. Morgan Neville made the documentary, which is called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead. It's a phrase that Welles said when he felt betrayed by Hollywood in the latter part of his life and couldn't get his movies financed. In the documentary, you realize how much Welles, despite having made a number of films, was haunted by the early success of his 1941 triumph, Citizen Kane, which he wrote, directed, and starred in. The documentary includes a dizzying array of images from Welles' numerous TV appearances. There's footage from the set of The Other Side of the Wind and interviews with many people who worked on the movie. Taken together, it's a portrait of a cinematic genius who was often his own worst enemy.
I can't even count the number of times I heard Orson say,
"The greatest things in movies are divine accidents."
Embrace that accident.
And my definition of a film director is the man who presides over accidents.
When I sat down with Morgan Neville before the premiere of They'll Love Me When I'm Dead at the Telluride Film Festival, I asked him if he benefited from divine accidents as a filmmaker.
I think Hitchcock had this great quote that said, in scripted film, the director is God. In documentary, God is the director. And so I feel like my job is always to try and tame the chaos of real life and make it make narrative sense.
And the chaos in this story is chaos on a cosmic level. I mean, everything that could possibly happen to a film happens in the making of this film. So where did you start working on it? What was your first involvement in this project?
Well, some people may know that this film has sat unreleased for 48 years, and people for decades have been trying to rescue it, and it's largely been sitting in a vault in Paris. So about 4 years ago, there was a book by Josh Karp, a journalist who's my producer now, about this film. And I read the book and I thought, oh my God, this is an incredible story. If I could ever get the rights to the footage, it would make a great documentary. And at that time, I reached out to Frank Marshall, who had worked as a young production manager, line producer for Orson in the early 70s on this film and had spent decades trying to get it rescued. And he and another young producer, Philip Resma, decided to kind of mount an Indiegogo campaign to raise money to rescue the film. And they said, we're just about done. We'll have the footage in weeks. It's all going to happen. And I thought, great. And I thought I was going to do this film 4 years ago. And I should just say, the film that Orson was making was called The Other Side of the Wind. And The Other Side of the Wind is a film about a film director at the end of his life that can't finish a movie. And Orson shot this film for 6 years and never finished it. So it's the most meta story of all time.
And was it always the idea that the documentary that you were making would be released around the same time as The Other Side of the Wind in the form that it's going to be seen very soon?
No.
No, that was not the plan at all.
No, I mean, I wanted to make a documentary and they wanted to make the feature and we thought we'd get separate financing and go on our own, you know, paths. But Netflix stepped up and were able to basically satisfy all the stakeholders in the rights to the footage. And they saw the added value of actually putting these things together. And now that I see them together, I understand how the documentary helps you understand what the feature's about, because the feature is a very complex Wellesian type story. And so is the documentary. But the documentary, I think, just gives tremendous context to what the film's about.
I want to talk to you about some of the elements that are in your documentary. You have footage from the film itself. You have interviews that Welles did around the time of its making, news conferences, award ceremonies, TV talk shows. There are interviews that you conducted recently with people who were involved in the project. How many different baskets were you drawing from in putting this film together?
It was an insane pinata of footage that we hit. And it's perfectly Wellesian, because everything about Welles, he's the most kaleidoscopic character I've ever come across. Because, you know, people say, well, Welles was absolutely like this. And other people that knew him said he was absolutely the opposite way. And I've come to believe that both are true, because Welles was this protean figure that presented a different face depending on who he was talking to and the time of day. To capture that, I think we felt like we had to go pull from anything you wanted to. You know, there were no boundaries, because that was the thing I got from Welles.
One of the things that's notable is that Orson Welles feels like he's caught between old and new Hollywood, that he comes from this more formal school of filmmaking, probably best represented in Citizen Kane, at a time when movies like Five Easy Pieces and Easy Rider and Bonnie and Clyde are studio films And it feels like he doesn't know his place in that world and where he is going to fit in and what his new model of filmmaking should look like.
So my story picks up in 1970, and Orson's been living abroad for 20 years. And he comes back to Hollywood in the midst of the new Hollywood boom. Like, everybody in new Hollywood worshipped Orson. And this should have been the most fertile, creative, exciting time of his life. And he never finished another scripted film. And so this story is kind of why not? And I think part of it is that even though he had opportunities to work for studios within New Hollywood, within that system when studios like Columbia and Paramount were experimenting, he was so unforgiving and uncompromising that he didn't want to give them any power whatsoever. And I think that became the sticking point, which is why he ended up financing this film independently. And I think the central question, really, the documentary is, you know, was Orson the victim of bad luck or was he the creator of bad luck?
We're talking with Morgan Neville. He's the director of the new documentary, They'll Love Me When I'm Dead. When I was watching your documentary, I was thinking about a great book by Norman MacLean called Young Men and Fire. Now, Norman MacLean wrote A River Runs Through It, another great book. And this book is about 12 smoke jumpers who died in Montana. And MacLean spent decades working on it, and he died without finishing it. And before he died, he said this: there's always a question one often asks himself painfully, is there nothing more to me than I have already found out?
Orson, think about it. He finishes Citizen Kane at 25. It's anointed the greatest movie ever made, and he has to contend with that throughout the rest of his life. So it was an unfair bar to be measured against, and it was a bar he hated to be measured against. The other thing, as an actor, and he was a very well-known actor, he was willing to prostitute himself, mm-hmm. and he said this freely.
And do commercials.
And do, you know, Paul Masson commercials and, you know, everything. But as a director, he remained virginal, mm-hmm. is what he said. To him, it was okay to do anything to make money as an actor to protect the sanctity of what his films were. The public didn't make that distinction.
Right.
And I think that was part of the problem. They didn't understand that Orson was the purest of artists when it came to being a film director and the most impure when it came to being an actor, because he thought acting was a kind of a base art form and the directing and filmmaking was, in fact, the pinnacle of art.
What do you think the story of the making of this film says about Hollywood and artistry and commitment? Is it a cautionary tale? Is it a hopeful tale? How would you describe it?
I think essentially what Welles wanted was the old-fashioned patron that you would find, you know, like a Medici or mm-hmm. somebody that would pay for him to make his movie. You know, I think that was what he needed, because if he was ever trying to play by any set of rules that made sense, i.e. business, it wasn't going to pencil out. You know, that Welles, in fact, had a hostility towards money people. He really didn't know how to deal with them, and he tended to treat them horribly. So it was a classic example of biting the hand.
Right. Now, and being your own worst enemy.
Yeah, but whether he did that to protect himself from feeling that he couldn't live up to that or he couldn't make money on movies, so he was going to sabotage the relationships first, you know, I think that's also a very valid argument. I mean, the big theme of the film, honestly, is betrayal. And it's the biggest theme in Orson's life, from his movies to his relationships. It's the betrayal of the studio system, in his mind, of many of his kind of friends and collaborators. And essentially, the story is the betrayal of his protege. So The Other Side of the Wind is about a film director and his protege, which is based on the story of Orson and Peter Bogdanovich. And Bogdanovich ends up playing the role based on Peter Bogdanovich.
And Welles betrays him.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is that Peter adored and still adores Orson. And this is when Peter Bogdanovich was the hottest director in America.
After Last Picture Show.
Last Picture Show, Paper Moon, and What's Up, Doc? Three monster hits. But he was still willing to throw all of that aside to do anything that Orson wanted, including starring in this film, including taking on Orson's critics like Pauline Kael, you know, which is a dangerous thing as a film director to be taking on the top film critic in the country at the time. But he would do anything for Orson. So what's interesting is Orson writes this script where Peter's character, as it were, betrays the director. And in a way, Orson was scripting what he predicted their relationship to be and challenging Peter, as he did, as he challenged everybody around him, to betray him.
Morgan Neville is the director of They'll Love Me When I'm Dead. Morgan, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I know what it is to be young.
And that is Orson Welles singing I Know What It Is to Be Young. Seems like he just couldn't resist trying everything. Welles' movie and Morgan Neville's documentary are on Netflix now. Coming up, an intrepid KPCC producer takes a motorcycle ride with cast members from Mayans MC.
Time takes away, so the story is told. I've asked so many questions of the wise men I met. Couldn't find all the answers. No one has as yet. There'll be days to remember, full of laughter and tears.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix film The Other Side of the Wind. Witness the last film from legendary director Orson Welles, The Other Side of the Wind. The story of a director named J.J. Jake Hannaford, who returns to Hollywood from years of semi-exile in Europe with plans to complete work on his own innovative comeback movie, also entitled The Other Side of the Wind. A cinematic event 40 years in the making. The Other Side of the Wind. Now streaming only on Netflix.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. One of the biggest hits in recent years for the FX cable network was Sons of Anarchy, a drama that revolved around a California motorcycle gang, and that show spawned the spinoff Mayans MC. Mayans follows the lives of a Latino motorcycle gang on the U.S.-Mexico border as its members wrestle with family issues, ambition, and drugs. KPCC's Sue Carpenter joined a few of the Mayans cast members for a motorcycle ride to talk about the show.
Richard Cabral doesn't just ride a motorcycle on the FX network show Mayans MC. He rides in real life.
We got the air ride in the front and the back, you know, we got the fishtails. Well, we went out Southern Cali style.
It's awesome.
Yeah, thank you. That's a Mayans head. It's all Mayans out.
Cabral, who plays Coco on the show, is meeting me for a ride with his castmate Emilio Rivera, who also rides.
Coco, he's riding that crazy stuff right there, you know what I mean?
There's a lot of line blurring between the actors who play bikers and many of their real-life stories. A lot of the mostly Latino cast came from less than ideal backgrounds. Extreme poverty, violence, gangs, and a lot of their life experience has been folded into the story of a Latino motorcycle club based just north of the California-Mexico border as it deals with a drug cartel, and members of the club secretly help a group of children who are trying to combat the violence.
Don't underestimate any man's capacity for despicable acts.
Slaughter every one of them.
That's a clip from episode 6 of Mayans MC's first season, which approaches gang life from an unusual perspective. It follows the life of a prospect named Easy, a guy who's trying to join the club but hasn't yet been accepted.
The new prospect.
Easy.
Gas it up and detail it. I don't want to see a speck of dust, huh?
Easy is played by J.D. Pardo, an Argentine El Salvadoran American who is best known previously for his role in the blockbuster Twilight saga. He met Cabral, Rivera, and I for lunch after our ride. Like the rest of the cast, he plays his part speaking English as well as Spanish.
I think you find, like, when the story goes to Mexico, it's just Spanish, right? But when it's here in California, it's more like Spanglish, which is so true, I think, to our culture, because we're always in and out.
Authenticity has been key to Mayans MC's success, which is capitalizing on the gritty authenticity of another hugely successful FX series, Sons of Anarchy, the original gun-running outlaw motorcycle series set in a fictionalized SoCal town. Sons ran for 7 seasons, from 2008 through 2014, with the Mayans plotline show creator Kurt Sutter decided to spin off into a sequel more than 2 years ago. The new show moves the action further south, to the border, and switches the focus. Mayans MC writer and co-creator Elgin James says Shakespeare's Hamlet was the concept for Sons, with Charlie Hunnam's Jack's character as the heir apparent.
Jax is already the prince, like, waiting to be king. This was more about, like, the Horatio Alger stories, right? This is about the short stories about this plucky little immigrant coming over the streets and then starting off, you know, through luck, meeting someone and becoming, like, you know, a janitor in a hotel and then taking the hotel over. It's basically about climbing up.
It's about the American dream, or a version of it.
Which is to become an outlaw, which is the most American of all dreams.
And it's a dream a lot of the Mayans crew have personally realized, including James. Long before Kurt Sutter tapped him to write the show, he was part of a Boston street gang for a decade and a half and served time in prison before his salvation through film. He co-wrote his first studio film for Universal Pictures, From Behind Bars.
I mean, that's the thing with Kurt, with the thing with all of us. Like, he could have chose anyone to work with him, right? And he chose a dude that I can't get a job at McDonald's or Costco.
Richard Cabral has a similar story. He was a gang member in East L.A. from the age of 13 and served time in a maximum security prison for violent assault before he discovered acting. It's an experience Cabral not only channels into his performance on Mayans MC, but through his one-man show, Fighting Shadows.
Scene standing outside the house. A car slowly pulls up to where you're at. Boom! The masked guy explodes from the fire of the gun. Boom, boom, boom! The car screeches out.
And, you know, I hate when people say, oh, you know, you guys are Latinos depicting, you know, drug dealers.
That's cast member Emilio Rivera.
Go watch Ozark because you got white guys playing drug dealers. Go ahead, go see that. Come on, where does it stop?
Mayans writer Elgin James agrees.
You know, for years we've been watching people that are black and brown be shown on the screen as these one-dimensional, stereotypical criminal characters, right? And all of us, like, this is our story, right? Some of us grew up in poverty, grew up incarcerated, you know, ended up being incarcerated, grew up in a cycle of violence. I won't be told that I can't tell my story just because it doesn't fit in for what nice people think is appropriate for society.
Clearly, a lot of viewers agree. Mayans MC was picked up for a second season after just 4 episodes and is currently the number one new series on cable this year for adults 18 to 49. And a lot of fans now recognize them on the street and ask for selfies.
You look so familiar. I'm like, I know those glasses. I know that feature. I didn't see the jacket. I'm like, and I'm looking at the bike and I see the Mayans on it.
Joshua Barrera is one of the many fans who rushed up to Cabral and Rivera as we were riding around town. Actor Emilio Rivera says the show appeals to a broad audience.
It doesn't matter what race, color, or creed, they're there, man. You dig what I'm saying? Because even if you think they're the goody two-shoe kind of people, they secretly watch it right there. You know what I'm saying? It's really surreal. And it's cool because you can actually watch what you think the motorcycle world is about in the privacy and security of your home.
We did some very bad things for some very bad people.
On SNL, they joke around about, like, all the Chris's, right?
That's J.D. Pardo.
The Chris Pratt's, the Chris Pines, the Chris Hemsworth. Well, there's opportunities for them, for there to be a lot of Chris's within the white actors. I constantly see the same Latino actors at auditions because there's just not a lot of us.
But that's changing. Jay Hernandez plays Magnum P.I. in the new reboot, and Nicholas Gonzalez stars in the ABC show The Good Doctor. And then there's Mayans MC. The season 1 finale airs tonight. For The Frame, I'm Sue Carpenter.
And that is The Frame for today. Our 9 p.m. broadcast is preempted tonight for election coverage. But if you missed any of this episode, you can find The Frame on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. I'm John Horn. Thanks for your time. We'll be back here on KPCC tomorrow.